Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and today I'm joined by the truly phenomenal Dr. Norval Van Coutts, a gentleman I met a while back in conjunction with a new technology to address traumatic brain injury, or TBI. And I use the word gentleman advisedly. Van is a classy gentleman who rocks a hat and a suit and comports himself with panache, shall we say. He's a dermatologist by training. He's a retired U.S. Army general and former commander of the Walter Reed Army Healthcare System. He now serves as a hospital system chief executive officer, and he is a truly inspiring and good individual focused on creating better access and outcomes for patients. So, Van, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan, very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you on this podcast today.
Well, the honor is truly mine. I'm so thrilled that we got to meet. We were introduced by a mutual friend, and you're an inspirational guy, and we're going to try and cover off some of the things you've done, and I'm going to try and get you to kick that humility into touch. So let's start with your education. What took you into dermatology? And by the way, that subject was, without doubt, my worst at medical school, and I had to do over dermatology.
So I tell you, it wasn't an immediate sort of thing. My father was an old style country doctor. You know, I got probably the closest to being a family practitioner. So I thought that that's what I wanted to be when I went into medical school as well. But I was exposed to dermatology in one of those lecture series that you have in your first year. And the dermatologist reminded me so much of me. And then he invited me to rotate with him. And from then on, it was an absolute love affair. I mean, this guy was the sharpest thing. He had on a burgundy leather jacket, a burgundy leather tie, blue and white striped banker's pants. He had on nice Italian shoes. And I said, that's a specialty I want to go into.
So that's where you get the sartorial elegance from.
That is it.
You know, it just as an aside, my paternal grandfather had died in many, many years ago, obviously, from pemphigus vulgaris. And that was pretty much the only thing I knew about dermatology.
Oh, and, my goodness.
Fascinating specialty. And I noticed that you'd given a lecture, actually, on one of my favorite things to torture medical students and residents with, which is like cutaneous manifestations of systemic disease or changes in the nails, for instance.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was always one of the things that I enjoyed doing, was going around and telling people just how important dermatology was, because everyone thinks, oh, it's internal medicines, it's the surgeons, whatever. And my whole thing is that if it's uncovered, if it's on uncovered skin, when you walk in the door, I can make the diagnosis. And not only can I make the diagnosis, but I can run rings around the internist with all of the different minutiae that I can add into it too as a dermatologist.
Well, I will also tell you, it's a very dangerous specialty, Van. I don't think I told you this story. I was in a commercial airport once, and I was sitting at the gate, and there was a guy, very well-dressed gentleman, sitting across from me. And I noticed that he had a lesion in between the corner of his mouth and his ear that was clearly a basal cell carcinoma, even to my untutored eye. And I thought, it was really bugging me, because I thought, I've got to tell him. So I thought, I'm going to be very, very careful. And I went up and very quietly whispered to him that I was a physician, that I noticed this thing on his face, and I highly recommended that he go see a dermatologist when he got to his destination. The next thing I knew, I was lying on the floor, dazed. The guy had thumped me. He punched me.
Oh, my goodness. So
I hope you never had issues with your practice.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've learned to just observe and then put my eyes back down.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you're a smarter man than me. So you retired in 2016 from the U.S. Army after a long and very distinguished career. And your rank at that point was Brigadier General. And you had responsibility as Commanding General of Regional Health Command Europe and as Command Surgeon for the U.S. Army based here in Europe and the 7th Army. Can you tell us a bit about your role, what it required, and what was your proudest accomplishment at that point in your career?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the question. So my role was really pretty broad then. During that command time, we consolidated all Army medicine activities under one command in Europe. So what had been a medical command, a dental command, and a public health command all became one. And while my headquarters was in Simbach, Germany, which is located near Ramstein Air Base, I actually owned all of the assets that supported bases and communities, even including things like the veterinary medical clinics. But really, all across Europe, in England, Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, Spain, Italy, and Turkey, I had launched a regional medical center, which is our big forward deployed medicine, and I had a hospital in Vicenza, Italy. So also had to maintain relationships with about 30 different host nation hospitals and health systems that were supporting our bases in those countries too. I had clinical oversight of the medical operations in the Persian Gulf. And then I had a different hat as the surgeon for the U.S. Army Europe. I had medical planning and interoperability with all of the European armies, and I had a special relationship that had to be maintained with the Israeli Defense Forces, because Israel is not part of our central command. It's for whatever reason, it's part of our European command. So I was gone almost all of the time, as you can imagine. But it was really very exciting. And to your question about what was my proudest, I think the proudest operational achievement would be the expansion of what we called EARTH, the Europe Army Regional Telehealth. So this was both real-time telemedicine and store and save. And so we went from doing about 200 telehealth cases a year to 2,500 in the first year that we really tried to grow this.
And this is pre-COVID, right?
Yes, absolutely. It started off as telebehavioral health. That's one of the things that the American Army always did very well. We expanded it to teledermatology because it's very easy to, if the pictures are very good, but we were doing telepre-op, telepost-op, telephysical exams, just about everything. And we had expanded beyond just the military clinics, but we also had the systems in the different embassy clinics across Europe, Central Asia, and into Africa. So it was a really exciting time. We were even looking at getting some bandwidth on a satellite to bounce our signals around Europe and Africa a little bit easier. If I had to say a relational thing, though, I think my favorite was rekindling the camaraderie and the relationship between the medical forces of the German Army and the American Army. It had suffered over the last years as we drew down and sort of restationed troops in and around Germany. And so it was really nice to really rebuild that friendship and the collegiality with our German medical comrades.
So a bit of a follow-on about telemedicine. Obviously, it's really taken off in the civilian world due to COVID. And, I have pals telling me, that they're now doing their pre-op and post-op clinics and that it's much better for the patients. They don't have to travel. You think about carbon footprint and all these other things. Why, if you were so far ahead of the game then, why was it not making its way into civilian practice?
Because nobody was getting reimbursed for it.
Aha.
And that's the biggest thing. In the military health system, it's socialized medicine. I mean, I never really worried about a budget as much as what it was I could do to help soldiers, sailors, their families, and things like that. In the private sector, it's, can I get reimbursed for this? So there was minimal reimbursement, and there were a lot of things that, you did not get paid for. Since the pandemic has hit, our Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services have relaxed a lot of the regulations around that and are actually allowing people to get rightfully compensated for all of the work that they're doing, giving people access to care. So that's why there's so much of an uptake now. And now that horse is out of the barn, there's no putting them back. I mean, telehealth is here and it's vaulted 10 years ahead of where it was in just this last year.
Yeah, in fact, an old friend of mine and collaborator on a couple of projects, Dr. Yulin Wang, I had the privilege of chatting with him on this podcast, and he has now launched something called the World Telehealth Initiative, which brings together the top-notch telehealth equipment that we now have and, high bandwidth communication means, and those lesser developed nations that many of us used to go and visit to perform. Well, I certainly went and performed surgery around the world, and telemedicine truly is a game changer. And I'd also like to ask a follow-on question about the relationship you talked about with your colleagues from the German medical side of the armed forces. What sort of differences did you see in approach to medical practice, other than, you know, setting aside the things like reimbursement, because you were exposed to many healthcare systems?
Yeah, no, exactly. So I really got to see how they created, you know, two or three different tiers of healthcare, because here in the U.S. we're under the false assumption that, you know, people are taxed, you know, out of their mind in Europe, and that goes to pay for premium healthcare that everyone has access to. In reality, it's several different tiers of healthcare. So to get to understand that, to get to understand how they use the concept of sending people once every so many years for 30 days for a cure to a health spa or something like that, and how they sort of wove that whole health and wellness piece into the practice of medicine. And then just their use of technology and even the rules around privacy were very interesting. So lots of different things that I picked up on. No one I can specifically say, but that's sort of the range of what I would see and experience.
Well, as you know, Van, I lived and practiced in the United States for, well, more than half of my career, and now back in the UK. And one thing I never understood, in the UK, we have pre-anesthetic rooms. And so as you're finishing up one patient, the next patient is being intubated and set up for surgery. And I asked every hospital I had privileges at and worked at, why don't you do this? It would reduce the number of operating theatres you need to build and run. So, you know, I think there are lessons that can be learned and applied. I was certainly not very successful at doing it. So tell me, you also served as Surgeon General for the US forces in Afghanistan. Tell us some of the situations you had to deal with. And, you know, I've never been there, and I suspect most of our listeners will not have been to that country. Also, tell us some of your impressions of Afghanistan as a nation.
Sure. So, you know, this was another very complex assignment that I had. I was there during 2012 to 2013, and I was actually dual-hatted. I was the Surgeon General of U.S. Forces Afghanistan with a headquarters on New Kabul compound across Kabul. And then I had a NATO role as the medical advisor to the commander of the ISAF Joint Command, which is the tactical arm of the NATO command that was there. So, and a headquarters on the airfield. I had a rear headquarters in Qatar as well. So I was bouncing around quite a bit because we could only have so many American boots on the ground in the theater at any given time. So I had the charge to develop relationships with the surgeons generals of the Afghan army, the Afghan police, the National Directorate of Security, and the Director of Public Health for Afghanistan. And then I also had to coordinate the interoperability between all the medical forces of the 50 NATO nations who were present with the coalition. Not all of them brought their medical forces, but all of them had some aspect of, you know, role one healthcare. They may not have brought a hospital, but they may have had a role one. So that was a bit of a challenge because there are so many individual national caveats. We go in thinking, hey, everyone's a human being. Everyone needs healthcare. We all practice medicine the same way. And it's just not the case. So one of the things I had to do was actually get out around the country. So I did about 133 convoys by ground and 42 battlefield circulations by air in that year just to get around to all of the places. We had American medical personnel that were embedded in the British Role 3 hospital. We had Americans embedded in the Spanish hospital. We had Americans embedded in the German hospital. And I had the responsibility of ensuring the smooth operations around that. I would say from a political standpoint, the Afghans want peace and stability. The Afghans always reminded me that the Americans had a big presence in Afghanistan in the 1950s. They built a lot of stuff and then we left. And then their impression of us is we come, we do a few things, the political winds change, and then we leave. And so they didn't know quite how to put a lot of stock into the things that we were trying to get them to do. But the reality is they were really very welcoming of just about anything and everything we were trying to do to help them rebuild their medical services. And I guess I think the other thing that I recognized about them too is that they were very cautious to use any of the equipment and supplies that we gave them. It was almost like a Depression era philosophy that if they used them and then the Americans left, they would never get this stuff back again. So they wouldn't use them. They had beautiful things stacked up in warehouses, but not using them at all.
Wow, really, really telling. Yeah, a friend of mine who distributes medical equipment all over the world speaks very fondly of his times in Afghanistan and the people there. And I've flown over it, and it looks like it must be a very dramatic countryside. Heaven for, wouldn't it be lovely if there were no more conflicts? But each conflict that humanity's been involved with has helped us advance how we deal with, I guess, civilian trauma, things like fluid management, the growth of plastic surgery after the First World War. What learnings have come from the tragic situations in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The war has always been the mother of medical invention, and certainly these wars are no different. So we learned a number of things. The first and foremost was we learned how to make better operational body armor and better armored vehicles for the ever increasing volatility and lethality on the battlefield. And even with that, we learned how to make better body armor for women, because we had more and more female soldiers deploying into combat operations where they had never really been before. We learned a lot about air evacuation. And you think, we know of air evac because we've been air evacing since the Korean War. And certainly, you've seen all the movies and all the stories about medevac in Vietnam, where we really had the lead worldwide in that. But there was a lot more that we could learn. So one of the biggest things that we did was codenamed Vampire. And this was a program where we began to give O negative whole blood in flight en route to the first or second level of stabilization surgery. And so we were able to get the first unit of blood actually in the patient within 6 minutes of being on the helicopter. And many of these guys would require 20, 30, 40, 70 units of blood to stabilize them and make sure that they live. So if we could get one, two, three, four, five units in them in flight, we were ahead of the power curve in saving their lives. There are a lot of lessons that we actually learned from the UK MERT. So that's the British Mobile Emergency Resuscitative Team that worked in the back of those big Chinook helicopters. And that is actually informing how we're working on our vertical takeoff and landing aircraft that the Marines have. And how do we put a medical carousel in the back of that where you could work on more than one Marine or soldier at a time? So lots of great stuff in life-saving. But maybe, as I think about it, maybe the biggest accomplishment of all is by the time I left, and it's not all due to me, but years and years of work with interoperability between us and the Afghan military health system. If you wound up being evacuated to a coalition hospital, you had a 96% chance of survival. If you got evacuated to an Afghan military hospital, you had a 96% chance of survival. So I think that is a real success story.
That is, and absolutely. And again, for people who haven't had the opportunity to travel, I was in Turkey and was chatting to an American colleague about the experience there, and this individual was sort of poo-pooing. And I said, "My dear chap, you need to see the quality of the hospitals there and how well trained people are and how well equipped they are. It's a good move for the world." So we met because of traumatic brain injury, and an injury that's clearly affected many young men and women of all nations who've served their countries. What are we doing about this to limit and treat the problem? And I guess better armor is saving lives, but then these young men and women are being exposed to concussive force. So talk a bit about TBI and the sequelae of TBI.
Yeah, so as you know, we've really been working in earnest on TBI for probably about the last 15 years. I mean, it was always there, and we just didn't know how to categorize it and how to qualify it. It took a while for us to really get the understanding of the science behind it, as well as that mental, emotional impact of it, too. So I'll just go back to Afghanistan. When I was in Afghanistan, we deployed a lot of blast gauges that soldiers and Marines would wear on their uniforms. So they would have a series of these gauges, and some were on the helmet, some were on the front of the uniform, some were on the back, and kind of distributed in their vehicles as well. And what we did was we analyzed the data from all of these devices, and we could really recreate the story of the blast. And what we learned was that there are literally hundreds of different blast waves that actually hit a body. There are circumferential waves that zing around inside of the helmet that really do shake up the brain. If you're inside of a vehicle, there were about 300 different waves that we identified that are ricocheting around inside of the vehicle, impacting your brain and impacting different parts of your body as well. So just understanding how these waves impact the body and the brain have really been important to our understanding of why there are gait and balance disorders, why there are cognitive disorders that are sequelae from this. So much of our rehab is now tailored to the specific symptom complex that a service member has. I mean, some of them are certainly global, and there's a baseline of care that each soldier with TBI gets. But as we understand more about what their specific sequelae are, we tailor the care to them. But in addition to the medical care, there's a layer of psycho-emotional things such as treatment for depression and stuff like that. And then there's family counseling that goes along with it, sports and activity, being able to divert people into that, being able to divert people into art and music and things like that that kind of try to rewire the brain. And even helping to create a community of support around each wounded veteran. There's really a very holistic approach to the way we're looking at it. And this is still an evolving field. I mean, there's still things that we are learning. There's still a lot of research that's going on. So I don't think we've heard the end of the story definitively quite yet about what TBI is and how to treat it.
Yeah, it astonishes me, Van, that there are still physicians who do not believe that there is such a thing, other than people who've been shot in the head or, have had a fractured skull. They think that it's play acting on the part of patients. And then I saw someone do a wonderful calculation of what it means to be hit by a concussive force from an explosive device, and basically the weight of the air in the environment traveling towards you at massive speed. And if we all remember that formula, E equals MC squared, it's equivalent to being hit on the head with a sledgehammer, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, more power to you in raising this awareness and helping these folks. So moving from the battlefield into the civilian world, you serve as President and Chief Executive Officer of the Holy Cross Health System. Tell us about the group for people who aren't familiar with it, and what attracted you to the role?
So Holy Cross Health is a two hospital, six community clinic health system here in Montgomery County outside of Washington, D.C. But we're actually part of a larger health system called Trinity Health, which has 92 hospitals spread across 22 service regions in the United States. So we're the third largest Catholic health system in the United States. And we call each of our regional health areas health ministries because we truly feel that we're carrying on the ministry of Jesus, the great healer. What really attracted me was that this is a mission, vision, and values-based organization. And leaving the Army, where I spent 36 years of my life, my entire adult life, to that date, it was a mission, vision, and values-based organization. And so I certainly felt a strong affinity to this organization and what it does, particularly in caring for the poor, the disenfranchised, the marginalized population among us, those that are most in need. So while we have, I have two hospitals. One is a smaller community hospital in the up county of Montgomery County. I have a large community-based medical center, the second largest hospital in the state of Maryland, which is the one that's closest to the DC line. But a lot of our work is done out in the communities that we serve. Our clinics are 10% Medicaid, which is a federal payer, and 90% charity. And we provide about $60 million worth of free care every year, probably another $5 million in relief of bad debt. And then we've got all kinds of things in our foundation that will fund people who cannot afford health care or who cannot afford to pay their rent on their apartment, and don't have necessarily a stable place to go after discharge. So we really spend a lot of time around those social influencers or social determinants of health.
Yeah, it is an amazing system, and I know you do phenomenal work there. And I just want to throw out as a physician who's practiced on both sides of the duck pond, and I've had the privilege of operating all over the world. I'm actually a fan of people not being bankrupted by having the tragedy of a major healthcare problem and, you know, perhaps deferring care because they can't afford it. To me, it's unconscionable, but I know I was deeply unpopular for saying that in some quarters in the United States. But tell me about some of the main focus areas for driving positive change for patients that you've been bringing to the table in your position.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the biggest thing is access to care. Because even here in the United States, with the great health system that we have, there are people who just cannot access our care. So getting the care that the patient needs kind of when, where, and how they need it is important. And right now with the boom in telehealth technology, you know, that's certainly helping. As it gets that care where it needs to be, which is closer and closer to the home, if not actually in the home, our goal is to partner with our patients and make it easy for them. And you know, making it easy is going to be challenging. Almost nothing in healthcare right now really is easy. But we want to get to where you almost have hospital in at home, where so much of their care can be done where health really happens, and that's in the home. It's healthcare that happens in the hospital or the clinic, but health is at home. So to be able to get the health there is important. The doctor's office at home. It almost goes back to the days of my father making house calls, when he used to carry a big black bag and he would give people injections. He would draw blood. He might even do an IV, you know, in their chair, in their living room or in their own bedroom, as opposed to them having to come into his office or the hospital. And so it's kind of like what's old is new. What's new is new and improved. We're kind of returning to that. And we have a major push to really get healthcare out there into the home, into the community. And one of the second order effects of all of this telehealth is a lot of our patients have been accessing us from, obviously from their home, but also from their work and sometimes from their car. So we can see over their shoulder into their living situation or into their work environment or into their car. And we can make, you know, safety evaluations. We can use all of that information to help us better form an idea of what the approach to treating that patient and to ensuring that they remain healthy is all about. So that's kind of what we're pushing here at Holy Cross.
Spot on comments. And a friend of mine who's a pediatrician was saying they actually prefer it because the kids aren't terrified coming into the doctor's office. And you can actually, by seeing them in their home environment again, you can make judgments as to whether, you know, how the child is behaving more naturally. So we'll have to talk some more about telemedicine, where it goes. But so just changing tack, we mentioned that the pandemic has changed patterns of telemedicine behavior. And certainly here in Britain, it's dramatically affected hospitals. Very little elective work or outpatient routine care. Massive needs for personal protective equipment as an unbudgeted cost. What patterns are you seeing in your system? And given the way healthcare is paid for in America, what are the implications?
You know, so I would say that much of what you're experiencing in the UK, we were watching on television and we saw everything that was happening in Europe and in the UK, you know, as the pandemic made its way here to the United States. And certainly in our first wave, it was like the Wild West. You know, PPE prices through the roof. If you could get it here today, gone tomorrow, your PPE would be sold to the highest bidder and things like that. And we actually, you know, were turning upside down financially and we had to stop all but the most emergent care. Now in wave two, we're actually much better off. And we learned how to cohort patients. We learned how to create separate treatment areas for COVID and non-COVID patients so that we could keep some semblance of normal operations going. We haven't had to curtail surgical procedures this time around. I mean, knock on wood, we still haven't gotten to Christmas and New Year's. We may wind up having to do that, but we actually now have the ability to plan a more metered walk back approach to turning off things in order to increase capacity for COVID patients. One of the things that we did was at about week 15 or week 16, we stopped and had what we call a pause and learn session. So it's like an interim after action review. And it was a methodology that used by NASA, which is our space administration. It's a real-time thing where you look at all the problems, divide them into domains, and then come up with actionable things that can help you move forward. And we cascaded that teaching all the way down to our frontline staff. And so, because we were able to do that, we have not been as stressed in this second wave as we were in the first wave. When you see on TV health systems that are being overrun and stressed, many of those health systems did not have patients in that first wave or did not have a lot. So they are really where the East Coast of the United States was, back in March, April, and May. And so I just think things are a little bit better for us right now. And part of it is if you take the time to take a pause and figure out what is working right and what is not working at all, make those corrections and move forward, things work out better. And as a leader, your staff trusts you more that, you're invested in this and you really can lead them through a crisis and out to the other side.
Yeah, and not only listening to your staff, but hospitals and doctors talking to one another and seeing what does and doesn't work can really save lives. So you've made contributions not just in your role with the armed forces and as a CEO, but multiple charities in America and overseas. And you've been inundated with numerous military and civilian awards. And I just want to mention a couple of them. The Distinguished Service Medal. To do well in the armed forces, good on you. A Knight of the French Legion of Honor, many, many others, including the Vatican. But you've been honored for all sorts of different work, and especially your charitable work, which really captures my attention. Of all your life's work so far, and excluding your family, what's the achievement that you're the proudest of?
Yeah, thanks. I think if I had to say one thing, it would be all the work that I have done with the children. Whether it was the Amerasian orphans during my 2 year time in Korea, or it was the children in the Republic of Moldova, where I had a special assignment and got to see the poverty there. I think, children are the future. That's a catchphrase, but it's really true. And it's not just the children of the well-to-do and the well-educated. All children are the future, even the most disadvantaged and marginalized. So if we can make their life better, if we can give them a better start in life, give them a sense of self-worth and value, how much better citizens of the world will they be on the other side? So really, that's it. I mean, I've been working in the Republic of Moldova for the last 20 years now, and I've talked to my son about carrying on the charity long after I'm dead, if there's still a need for it, or finding other places where children are marginalized and need a helping hand and a step up. So that's probably my proudest work.
And it's phenomenal work, and I've read a lot about what you've done, Van. There's a charity I came across in Africa, started by a British and an American guy, two really great kids when they started it, and their catchphrase is "From cradle to career," and they sort of wrap these most disadvantaged children up and help them become powerful leaders. And you're right, the potential's phenomenal. So bless you for doing that. You've said before that healthcare is a right and not a privilege. What do you think we can do as healthcare providers? What more can we do to ensure better access to medicine for those who need it most?
Yeah, so I think one of the things is we really need to get to a system of true health equity and not just try to get to health equality. So equality says that we all have access to the same healthcare. Equity says that each of us has access to the healthcare that we each need individually to positively impact our health or our lives. So this is healthcare that's free of bias. It's full of cultural understanding, and most importantly, it's taking the time to really understand each patient as an individual and their needs, and not just as a member of, a distinct racial or ethnic group or something like that. I think that's where we need to go. And with all of the things around racial harmony and unrest that we've seen here in the United States recently on the healthcare side, one of the biggest things is that the pandemic has really laid bare the issues that we have around health equity. And so it's staring us right in the face. And so I think what you'll see moving forward is a lot more work around that. And that shouldn't just be limited to us here in the United States, but there's health inequality and health inequity everywhere around the world. We've really got to get to that, the individual human being.
Yeah, and I think maybe another lesson the pandemic has taught us is that someone sneezes in Wuhan and someone in Edinburgh catches a cold. And the reason that these zoonotic diseases flourish is because people are living under extreme poverty. And if we can improve their lot, then if set aside the moral and ethical imperative, it's better for everyone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that we've learned from this is, you know, health security is equal to national security.
That's very well said. So, Van, I ask all my guests a version of this question, and given your obvious leadership experience and qualities, one which I am sure you can give a great answer to. So let's pretend that you wake up tomorrow and your title is now Supreme Commander of the Global Healthcare System. What three things would you do to improve human health?
Yeah, so I think you'll hear sort of my pet peeves here. So first of all, I develop a system that will control the cost of devices and medications, which help to drive up the cost of healthcare. That's the biggest thing. Then I would create a global super fund that would help to cover the cost of providing care to those uninsured and to all the poor around the world. And then the third thing I would do is I would make the social determinants and those influencers of health a big part of any policy discussion at the highest levels of government. And then within that, there's got to be something actionable, right? You can't just talk about it. So I would create a branch that would actually go out and deal with clean water and safe food, because in many instances, water and food are just as important as medicine, and they are medicine. And then I'm going to just throw in, I'm going to take literary allowance here and just throw in a fourth thing. The fourth thing would be, you know, education, not just education around the populace and eradicating healthcare illiteracy, because there's certainly a lot of that, but also internally facing to healthcare providers and healthcare leaders, cultural competency, cultural understanding, elimination of racism, because in whatever form it's found in, you know, whether it's conscious or unconscious, whether it's systematic or whether it's just racism in the moment, all of that becomes a healthcare emergency at some point in time.
Well, I agree with everything you've said. And years ago, a friend of mine, we were all wearing sort of the banned guns badge, you know, the red circle with the strike through it, which of course is a deeply unpopular thing to say in the United States. And in fact, I had a patient who was very strident in his complaints and said that I was a doctor and I should stick to looking after healthcare issues. And I said, well, thousands of people in this country die every year as a result of gunshot injuries, more than anywhere else on the planet. That's a healthcare problem, right?
That's a healthcare emergency as well. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you do wake up tomorrow morning with that title, Van. I cannot think of anyone better to hold it. Doctor, I should say General Norval Van Coutts, it's been an immense pleasure and honor having you on the podcast. And it's become a bit of a truism in the United States when meeting someone who's given military service to say thank you for your service. You've given service as a physician in the military, in philanthropy. You're an amazing guy, and I'm thrilled to know you.
Thank you, Jonathan. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to our continuing friendship and to work to getting to those lofty goals in healthcare.
Wouldn't that be lovely? Well, sadly, that's all for today. But please join me, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, on the EMG Health Podcast. Bye for now. And please, everyone, stay safe, stay well, stay educated.